Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 15th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's episode, I want to thank those of you who support the show and ensure that it is free for everybody to download. This week's top supporters on Patreon include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Leonard Prince, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. If you want to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, we've got a great show for you this week. I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Perry Klass. She's a professor of journalism and also pediatric medicine at New York University. She's the co-director of NYU Florence and national medical director of Reach Out and Read. She also writes the weekly column The Checkup for the New York Times, and her new book is called A Good Time to Be Born: How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. We talk an awful lot about how far we've come with regards to not infant mortality, but infant thriving. We talk about what pediatric medicine really does entail, and we spend a fair amount of our conversation discussing vaccines and their importance for public health. This is a really good one. It's informative, and it's, I think, a really important conversation. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Perry Klass. Perry, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm so glad to be here.
So I'm really excited to talk about your new book. It's been out for a bit now. I've always got a bit of a backup here on the show, but anytime a publisher sends a book my way that really stands out to me, I get thrilled and I reach out immediately and say, let's do this. So your book is A Good Time to Be Born: How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. And of course, you have a lot of personal and professional connections to this topic. So I thought maybe before we dive into the book itself, we would take a step back and talk a little about who you are and kind of the twists and turns of your career up to this point.
Absolutely. So I'm a pediatrician. I went to medical school and then trained in pediatrics in Boston at Children's Hospital, and this would now be the late 1980s. And I've worked as a primary care pediatrician in neighborhood health centers, in public hospitals, and also all along, ever since medical school, I've been writing about my training, about the world of medicine, about what I was learning. And this started as kind of very personal writing. To be honest with you, it started by accident in that I was invited to write about the experience of going to medical school. But over time, I also got to learn about reporting. I got to figure out how to learn about the parts of medicine which weren't mine, but where I would have to ask someone to explain to me. And then I would have to take what I understood and figure out how to explain it to the general public. And my job right now is a wonderful job, kind of shaped to fit me. I'm probably the world's only professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University. And I teach both in the Journalism Institute, I teach journalism students, and I also teach in the medical school and work in the pediatric clinic and work with pediatric residents and trainees. And a lot of my writing is connected to this. I write about children's issues, some that I come into contact with personally, but often gives me the opportunity to call up other people who know much more than I do and try to understand complicated issues that affect children and families. I do a lot of journalism. I write a weekly column in the New York Times about children's issues and children's health, and do various other kinds of writing. And I got obsessed with this question of how the world changes as infant and child mortality drop. And I, for several years, this was just the way I kept thinking about history, the way I kept everything I kept seeing in literature. You take me to an art museum and I find the picture of the dead child. And I just got so interested in this question, which began to seem to me like the kind of greatest but curiously unsung achievement of humanity.
You know, I have a little bit of a non sequitur. Well, it might seem like a non sequitur, so bear with me, because something came up in my mind just then as you were talking about how you came back to this sort of question that's been in your mind for so long, or I guess this interest and this really this celebration of modern medicine and how far we've come. I recently, on the other podcast I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, we did a 12-hour live show, and it was really brutal, and we filled it with all sorts of fun content. And one of the things that we did was a little segment called Is It True? And I, in my tricky planning, asked something along the lines of the average lifespan of an Egyptian pyramid builder was 44 years. And it kind of swept some people, but other people got what I was getting at right away. And really the answer to that was absolutely not. That was the average life expectancy, but not the average lifespan that, you know, we've long had long lives. It's biologically, it's fundamentally within us that we can live a very long time. And Socrates famously, I think, died at the age of 80, but...
And not naturally.
And not naturally. Yeah, so he could have kept going. But of course, life expectancy was that low because so many babies and children died. So many that it pulled down the average.
Completely. And that's absolutely true. I mean, the ubiquity of infant and child death all through history, the way it was tragic but expected and to some extent had to be accepted because what can you do, was part of it. And then the other part of it for me was how recent it was. That is to say that in my grandmother's era, a century ago, the 1920s, in New York City, when my parents were being born, when my grandparents, my grandmothers, you know, women I knew, were having their children, we were still talking about a world in which if you sat down and went around the table, pretty much everybody would have lost a child, lost a sibling, lost a good friend in school. It was just not such a surprising or remarkable event, even that late. And so then I began to think about the fact that, you know, when I trained in pediatrics in the 1980s, children were not supposed to die. Every child's death, every baby's death was almost always a thing that should not have happened. There should have been better safety measures. There should have been better protective measures. If it was an accident, if it was a car crash, if it was a safety issue, or if it was a medical death from a, you know, terrible disease, there was a sort of and we haven't learned how to do that yet. The surgeons don't know how to repair that most extreme cardiac congenital anomaly. There was no sense of acceptance. Well, you know, there are just some of these diseases. If it was a particularly bad infection, then we hadn't moved fast enough or we didn't have strong enough antibiotics. If it was a particularly dangerous congenital anomaly, then we hadn't learned how to repair it yet. If it was a metabolic disease that nobody knew quite how to handle. Every one of those was a challenge. And, you know, there was a long, long list of victories from pediatric leukemia to many of the congenital heart diseases to prematurity. There were all these things which 50 years, 40 years, 30 years ago, they wouldn't have been able to do. And now they can do it.
Right. And what does that really say culturally, societally? I mean, there's so many downstream effects from this incredible change almost overnight. I mean, obviously not overnight. It's been iterative, but it has happened so quickly within our recent history. And I guess the first thing that sticks out to me is how quickly we forget, how quickly young mothers now probably don't even realize the incredible risk that modern medicine has helped to mitigate or overcome. And I see it often in my work. It's been a tough, how do I put this? As I've developed in clinical psychology, there have been a lot of things that have bumped up against my scientific skepticism and my more like logical positivistic view, because lately I've been thinking more along the lines of a constructivist view. And one of the things that I realized is that historically, when I might have turned my nose up to a young mom who says, no, I want a natural birth and I don't want hospital and I don't want this and I don't want medicine. And I'm like, come on, like, do you understand what medicine and hospital has done for us in the past 100 years? At the same time, there's a part of me that empathizes with the idea that no, we don't, because we just don't see it the way that we used to. And we just are so comfortable in this kind of post-medical world where infant mortality is significantly lower than it was. It's so strange how quickly we forget as a society.
I think that's a great point. And it's one of the things that I wanted to write about in the book was not just how quickly we forget as a general public, but even the difference in medical training between the diseases that you've seen that are real to you, that terrify you, and the diseases that you've just learned about in books. And I wanted to think about how that may, to some extent, have to do with issues like parents who worry about vaccines because they feel the vaccine is more frightening than the disease. But of course, the disease is, in many cases, not around and people haven't seen it. But I also wanted to write about the difference for doctors, for anyone who works in healthcare, between the disease, not just that you've seen, but the disease that you've worried about. Because there were diseases that I lay awake worrying about when I was a resident. You know, did I miss Haemophilus influenza type B disease? Did I miss bacterial meningitis? Did I send a child with a high fever home from the emergency room and that child really had developing bacterial meningitis and is going to come back tomorrow morning dead or devastated? And I worried people my age, and this isn't unique to me, pediatricians my age and older worried about those diseases every day, every night, in residency, in practice. And now that we immunize against them, I can hear that when I start to talk to the residents about them, they look at me the way I would look at my teachers when they were talking about polio. And, you know, and there's a little bit of a, you know, I would look at my teachers when they talked about polio, and a part of me would be thinking, that's fascinating. How interesting. You actually had wards full of patients with polio. That's so interesting. And part of me would be thinking, but it's irrelevant because I've got patients to take care of and none of them are going to have polio because nobody gets polio anymore. And so I think that that question of how we remember and what we're scared of and how we use it to think about risk. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about in the book, I mean, as I say, I think this is an amazing story of human achievement, and it's a story of science and a story of medicine and a story of public health, but it's also a story of parents and parent advocacy and the kind of change that can happen when parents realize that, no, we don't have to accept this. This is not, it does, there's a great moment in the book when one of the doctors I write about, Josephine Baker, who's a heroic, pioneering public health doctor in New York, realizes that summer heat does not have to kill babies, that the summer diarrhea is not inevitable, that if you breastfeed babies and pasteurize the milk, teach hygiene, and the babies don't drink any kind of dirty, contaminated water or milk, they won't get diarrhea and die. And if that's a revelation for the doctors and the nurses that, you know, the summer does not have to mean babies dying, think about what it means for parents in terms of what they would have had to accept as part of the territory and what they can begin to think is perhaps within their power.
It's almost difficult. I'm not a mom. You know, I'm a mom to a dog, and that's a very different situation. although there are moments where I think it might be similar. And it's hard for me to envision, you know, I think that's kind of, that's the whole of it when it comes to empathy, right? Is that we work really hard to maintain humility and to really try to understand the world through other shoes by reading from them, learning from them, talking to them. Yet there's still always going to be a disconnect between my perspective and someone else's. And I try to envision what it must feel like to be a mom to a young one in a time and a place where risk abounds. And I'm sure that there were different strategies at the time. There were some moms who were blissfully unaware. There were some moms who were a little lower down, you could say, on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, who were just struggling to feed their children. So the prospect of disease might not be at the forefront of their minds. And then there were probably moms who were cripplingly and debilitatingly scared and anxious all the time during the era where things like being in the summer meant your kid could have intractable diarrhea and die.
So, I mean, I think one of the things that I wanted to write about, and the book actually, although I am arguing, as the title says, that it's a good time to be born, I'm also acknowledging that it's not like parents nowadays live without anxiety. And in fact, I think we see a full range among parents nowadays, that there are parents who find the whole experience of taking care of a child nowadays. And I understand that I'm speaking in the middle of a pandemic and it's an exceptionally anxious time. But even before the pandemic, I think there were many, many very, very anxious parents. And it's one of the things I wanted to write about is objectively with a sort of level of safety or a level of certainty that many, many bad things won't happen, which my grandmother didn't have, do we actually think that we're more anxious or less anxious than my grandmother? And the answer is, of course, very individual. There are going to be parents on every level, from parents who lie awake nights terrified of all kinds of terrible things that might happen to their children, to parents who seem to be able to take it more confidently and casually. And my guess is that that's been the range of human reaction all through time, that there have always been very anxious parents, less anxious parents, extremely not anxious parents. And I don't know whether it's really connected to the actual odds that the child faces, because this is, you know, this is a hard job. You have a child, here you now have somebody who, for whom you're responsible, somebody very vulnerable, somebody you love more than you thought you would ever love anything or anybody. And you're faced with a huge array of decisions. And there are decisions which parents agonize about, famously, but there are also decisions which parents haven't agonized about historically, but are also tremendously important. I mean, if you look back on your own childhood, you can probably think of many decisions that your parents made, which really had tremendous impact on who you are, decisions about, you know, where you grew up and how you grew up. And they may not have been the decisions that tortured your parents for hours and hours and hours. They probably in some cases were just kind of the facts of life for them. This is where we're going to be and this is what we're going to do, and you're a member of the family and so you're coming along. But then there are other decisions where parents suddenly get themselves caught up in the idea that everything rides on making this decision, and am I making it right or am I making it wrong? And one of the things that I argue in the book is that it's possible that our very sense of safety, the idea that actually we, much luckier than parents through all the centuries of history, we can actually look at our children and think, I expect them all to live to grow up, you know, barring terrible accidents and terrible unexpected tragedies. Yeah, I expect them all to live to grow up. And that possibly that very sense of safety for some parents leads to a sort of, but that's of course only if I make all the right decisions. It's really all on me. There, you know, it can be, because my grandmother, of course, didn't think that it was all on her because she knew that some children weren't going to make it, that there were a bunch of bad diseases out there. There was the polio epidemic every summer. And it's not that she didn't have decisions to make about exposure and safety, but she knew those bad things were out there. And I wonder if the very safety in which our children now do grow up leads some parents at least to feel a almost crushing sense of responsibility to make the right decision after the right decision after the right decision to keep them safe.
Yeah. And really, I think, and everything in between. I mean, you're right. It's so much of it is about control and safety, and whether it's an illusion of control or an actual sense of control. You know, one of the things that I often talk about with my patients is I bring up the serenity prayer very often. And it's funny because I'm not religious at all. And my patients, of course, run the gamut, like everybody runs the gamut. So sometimes we take God out of the equation and sometimes God is front and center. But that serenity prayer, which is really all about being empowered to affect change where you can, being comfortable sitting with grace where you have no control, and of course, being wise enough to know the difference, it really speaks to a fundamental challenge that all of us face in life. And I can only, you know, imagine, I mean, not to be flippant, that's the phrase, but really, I can only imagine how difficult it must be for parents in the face of maybe new challenges, you know, because you're right. Scarlet fever is not as big a fear anymore. Even measles, even mumps, even rubella, things that we vaccinate against, are not fears for most parents anymore. But of course, we don't let our kids just go out and play. When I was a kid, I was born in 1983. You know, I'm in my late 30s. And when I was a child, the rule was be back by the time the streetlights come on. My parents had no idea where I was or what I was doing. And it just, there wasn't a fear around that. We walked to school when we were in late elementary school. Now parents, kids won't be released until their parents pick them up in many, at least inner city schools. Like I live in LA and that's the rule here. It's a completely different world. And of course that happens, you know, every few decades after every few decades. I'm also really fascinated by, as you were talking about, this kind of big range between a false sense of security to an overly sort of debilitating, we might almost say neurotic sense of anxiety, where, you know, it's like anything and everything I do has a crushing effect on my child's life. I have to make the right decisions. And really anything in between. I'm wondering, just as a random aside, if you have, in your experience as a pediatrician, seen, and there's probably actually good evidence about this, but from an anecdotal evidence perspective, based on my friends who have children, I see a big birth order effect in my friends, that early on, they're so much more freaked out and they're so much more careful. And by child like three, they're like, yeah, he's kind of raising himself. Do you notice that with parents at all?
Yes, overall, I think that, you know, we're all, and I don't mean to make this sound like an us them, I'll speak as a parent too. I think that the experience of having that first baby, unless you bring to it experience that most of us don't, that sense of, you know, absolute responsibility, that sense of the baby's vulnerability, but maybe also that sense of how fragile the baby is, you know, that worry, will he actually be okay? And then, of course, I mean, children are fragile. I'm a pediatrician. I believe in putting them in car seats. I believe in, you know, protecting them and putting them down to sleep safely. But it is also true that the experience of watching your child grow up also teaches you that children are also resilient and sturdy. And maybe the most important message that sort of keeps you sane as a parent is that, for the most part, there is no one tiny little decision which is going to determine the future, as long as you're careful about the safety precautions and, you know, follow basic guidelines. You don't actually, the level of, you know, worry that we sometimes invoke over, you know, when should I start solid foods with this baby, or, you know, is it okay? You know, I've been breastfeeding, but now here we are at 8 months and he's not interested anymore, or I'm not interested anymore. Is that going to the idea that you're going to be able to do everything perfectly, I think usually disappears with the first child, because you don't do everything perfectly. You figure out how to live with the particular child that you've been dealt, but also with the particular parent that you turn out to be, that your partner turns out to be, if there are two of you doing it together. And you kind of work it out, and you do learn that children are, thank goodness, forgiving and resilient, and that the most essential lesson of parenthood is, you know, tomorrow you get to get up and do it all over again. And that's both good news and bad news. You do get to get up and do it all over again tomorrow. And you don't actually get to say, you know what, I've been doing this parent thing every day for a couple of years, I'm just going to take a break. Tomorrow, you know, of course not. It's a sort of a daily responsibility. And you, I think as a parent, for the most part, you kind of come to believe in that very dailiness. And that, you know, if I wasn't a particularly brilliant parent today, maybe I'll be a better parent tomorrow. And, you know, I'm going to get another chance to try to negotiate some of these same questions.
You know, the amount of pressure, and especially within the context, because of course we could broaden this up to so many things, but within the context of the medical establishment, within the context of public health initiatives, the amount of change and the amount of risk mitigation that we've seen, as you mentioned, in the not so distant future has been profound. And I thought maybe you could help shed light on maybe some of the differences and the nuances between diseases that parents legitimately don't need to worry about anymore at all, because they're either, for all intents and purposes, eradicated, at least here in the US or in the developed, you know, West, versus diseases that are still a risk, which is why we do things like vaccinate and why it's so important that we remain vigilant about the things that we don't have a lot of firsthand knowledge of, but could very easily become, a violent part of our lives if we're not vigilant.
Sure. Let me start with a little bit of a hymn to vaccination, because pediatricians love vaccination. Pediatricians truly, truly, truly love vaccination and vaccines. And we give them, we believe in them, and we're so grateful to them. So let me start by saying that there are a whole bunch of diseases that we still vaccinate against that we never see. I'm just going to say that there was a study that just came into my email box today, in which researchers looked at vaccination programs in 98 countries and found that vaccines against 10 major diseases averted an estimated 37 million deaths between 2000 and 2019 in low and middle income countries globally. So, I mean, millions and millions. Look, the whole point in pediatrics is to try to keep the kids from getting sick if you can. We would rather immunize everyone against measles than treat kids who are sick with measles. So let's start with, well, actually, let's reach back to smallpox, which is the only disease that, as human beings, we've actually eradicated and even stopped vaccinating against. So smallpox was a companion and a misery to human beings through long, long, long centuries and millennia of our history, right? People always point out that Egyptian mummies have been found scarred by smallpox. It was a terrible disease. Everybody knew that it was catching. Everybody knew that it was devastating. It killed people. It blinded people. It was especially devastating to babies and small children. It was a terrible, terrible disease. And it's gone. It's like you're looking at the huge pie diagram of human misery, and you can just say that slice is gone. Nobody on the planet right now is suffering from this, because we figured out over time, human beings figured out how to turn on the body's immune system without having to have the disease, right? The first thing that people figure out is that you can do what's called variolation, inoculation. You can give people a tiny dose of smallpox, a little pus from an infected person, a little scab, and you can hope that they'll get a mild case of smallpox and then they'll be protected. And that's practiced many parts of the world. It's practiced in Africa. It comes to the New World actually with enslaved people who know how to do it and teach Cotton Mather how to do it. It's practiced in China. It's practiced in the Near East. It comes to England by way of Turkey. But it's a really dangerous thing to do because you're giving somebody a case of smallpox, and smallpox is a nasty virus. And sometimes the person who gets inoculated or variolated, variola is the name for the smallpox virus, sometimes that person gets a mild case of smallpox and is then immune. But sometimes that person gets a bad case of smallpox and dies. And it's not something you can control. But what you're building on is the knowledge that if you have even a mild case of smallpox, you're immune. And then humans figure out that actually you don't have to have smallpox, you can have cowpox. Because people who work in dairies, people who are around cows and get the related vaccinia virus, cowpox, they have a much milder illness. It doesn't kill them. It doesn't kill them. And they're still immune. So what you figure out with vaccination, which is named for that vaccinia virus, is that you can turn on the body's defenses without actually having to have the disease. You can have a much milder version. And that miracle that you can turn on all of those incredible defenses and become like someone who's already passed through the danger of the disease, but not have to have the disease, that's a remarkable thing. So some of the diseases that you talk about that we don't see anymore, I've never seen a case of diphtheria. I've never seen a case of polio. These are diseases, again, huge categories of human misery and suffering and mourning and, you know, terribly damaged lives and families, which are just gone. But at this point, polio is not eradicated. We've been very close to eradicating polio for a long time. It turns out that one of the things which viruses thrive on is, along with healthcare systems that are vulnerable and poverty, also war and social unrest and refugee situations. Polio's not gone yet. We keep on immunizing kids against it. We no longer use the live virus vaccine because it turned out in this country that the very, very, very few cases of actual infection related to the live virus vaccine were the only cases of polio that we were seeing. So we switched over.
Right, because we were so close. Like, the only cases left are in a couple of African nations and, like, Pakistan. I think there's only 4 or 5 countries at this point.
Well, very few countries, and it's, I think, been mostly in Pakistan. There's actually been some political turmoil around the vaccination teams. There's actually been some hostility and even terrorism directed against the vaccination teams. And again, there aren't a lot of cases, but it's not gone. And it does seem to thrive on the sort of disorder, political turmoil areas that are not stable. We can all dream about a day when maybe it'll be possible to stop vaccinating children against polio, because polio has no animal reservoir. It only happens to human beings. And you could imagine a day, as with smallpox, in which you said, hey, you know, keep the recipe for the vaccine in case we ever need it again. But we might be able to eradicate this whole slice of suffering. And similarly, that was something that people hoped to do once with measles. Measles eradication, at least in this country, once seemed very close, but we've gone in the other direction since then at times. We've had measles outbreaks, we've had under vaccination and unvaccinated children. And measles is very definitely still with us. It's still killing a certain number of children every year. And it's especially dangerous to children who are not well-nourished, children who have other diseases. So children in less affluent countries are at higher risk. But those are some examples. Measles is a disease which is not, we had an outbreak not long ago in this country. Polio and diphtheria, diseases that I've never had to worry about or try to diagnose.
I just wanted to clarify a handful of things because I think you made some really, really important points there. The first being that diseases like polio, for example, where there is no animal reservoir. So it's only cycling throughout human beings. And in some cases, like you said, we would have novel cases pop up because of the live virus vaccine. That if and when we get to a point where every single human being on the planet is vaccinated and there is no longer a potential for polio to spread, that is eradication, as opposed to a disease like Ebola, for example, where Ebola lies in wait in other animals. So it's got a reservoir, a natural reservoir. It's always going to pop up. We're always going to see new infections with Ebola. It's uneradicatable. That said, we can still control its spread. So there's a fundamental difference there in the types of infections that we're talking about, right?
That's absolutely right, in the sense that we can only dream of real eradication in diseases, as you say, which don't have an animal reservoir. And I mean, we could dream of eradicating the disease in human beings in a situation in which we wanted to imagine vaccinating everyone in the world. We could try to dream of a world in which there were no human cases, but the flu is another good example, would still be out there if we let our guard down. The decision that was made with smallpox, because it had no animal reservoir, was, you know, you can actually track the last cases, the last case of somebody, you know, out in the world who catches smallpox, the last case of someone in a lab who catches it in a lab experiment, and then there isn't any more. And so you can dream of that with diseases like polio, or even with diseases like measles, is that our long coexistence with these viruses could just be over. Dr. Fauci memorably said last week in the briefing that viruses cannot evolve if they can't reproduce. And this is a coexistence. The viruses which can only live in us have been living in us in various kinds of balance, in most cases, for quite a long time. We're seeing what happens right now in the world when a new one shows up. But there is the possibility with the viruses, which are only human infections, that you can just eradicate the disease. It's not a simple thing. We've only managed it once with a huge international effort, but it is a possibility.
Do we still vaccinate in this country, in the U.S. specifically? I have listeners from all over the world, so let me clarify. In the U.S., do we still vaccinate children against polio?
Yes, we vaccinate children against polio. We don't use the live virus vaccine. We use the injectable vaccine.
We do. Oh, okay. I was wondering. So it must be an early childhood vaccination, because what are the vaccines that I see a lot of my friends who were born, let's say, for example, in India or other Southeast Asian countries, but then immigrated here as children or as young adults, who have the scar on their shoulder from their vaccinations?
Well, the scar on your shoulder classically was your smallpox vaccine. But if your friends are younger, they may not have that. Some places, there's another vaccine called BCG, which I think some places, the way it's administered, can leave some marks. But I could be wrong about that, because it's not a vaccine that we give in this country. I have a round circle mark on my shoulder, which is my smallpox vaccine.
Right. Okay. Small. Gotcha.
But I'm older than you are.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So it's not the polio vaccine.
No, polio does not leave it. As I say, I think that if people who are too young to have had the smallpox vaccine have any vaccine scars at all, it's probably the BCG vaccine, which is a vaccine against tuberculosis, which we don't use in this country, but is used in many countries around the world.
You're right, because that's why, like, I have some friends who are healthcare professionals, and they always have to do the thing that's so annoying when they get the TB test, when they get a new job, because they're like, I'm vaccinated. And so they have to get their titers checked or whatever. Yeah, that would make sense. All right. Interesting. Okay. So yeah, it's kind of going back to a disease like measles then. I think measles is a good point of focus, right? Because it could very easily, as you mentioned, take hold within the population if we dip below what we generally refer to as quote unquote herd immunity. Like we're vaccinated against measles. So for the most part, people who are following public health guidance and who are listening to their physicians are protected. It's such an easy thing. It's a jab. It's a jab when you're little, you barely feel it, and then you're protected. But we're getting to a place where there's denial or there's resistance.
Measles is a great example, and measles is a fascinating disease, and I write about it in my book because with polio, when you bring out the polio vaccine in my grandmother's era, you're offering a vaccine against something which is the stuff of parent nightmares, right? Polio is a disease which comes through every summer in the 30s and 40s into the 50s, and all of a sudden children who were perfectly healthy fall sick, some of them die, some of them end up permanently disabled. There are empty seats in the classroom. You have to decide whether to let your child go out and be around other children. It's a terrifying, terrifying disease. Measles is probably the most infectious disease that we know. Everybody gets measles. Measles is not this is the mark of doom. It comes in the night. Your child was fine yesterday. Oh no, your child has polio. Measles is a really common disease. In fact, when I was training, if you were born before 1957 and you didn't think you had measles, the rule was, yes, you did. You had measles. Everybody had measles. You could just assume it. It was so infectious. Measles is a dazzlingly infectious disease. You have one kid with measles at a theme park, if you remember the Disneyland epidemic, and you can have hundreds and hundreds of exposures. So everybody got measles. And the truth is that though measles is a miserable disease, high fever, kids are really cranky, they feel miserable, they have a very dramatic rash, most kids got better. And so therefore, most of the adults looking at the kids would, thought of this as a disease that you had in childhood that everybody got, but not necessarily as, that drumbeat of death. It wasn't quite as terrifying. And in fact, when the measles vaccine becomes available, first in the 1960s and then in the form of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, it's a very different argument, both for pediatricians and for parents, to say it is still worth vaccinating all the children. First of all, because there actually are rare but very, very serious complications. There's measles encephalitis. That's what kills Roald Dahl's daughter. There are really, really serious complications of measles. They're rare, but when you've got a disease that every single child has, you're multiplying a rare occurrence by an extraordinary number of possible exposed children. So yes, you want to vaccinate children because there are these rare but completely preventable complications. But then the other reason that you realize you want to vaccinate children is that there are other people being exposed, right? Children who, for example, are immune compromised are being exposed, right? I mentioned the incredible victories of being able to combat childhood leukemia. But you've got a population of children out there who don't have fully functioning immune systems because they're on chemotherapy or they have immune compromising disorders. So there are vulnerable populations. Babies are vulnerable. We don't give the first measles vaccine till babies are 12 months old, but measles can be really, really dangerous to infants. So, if there are children running around with measles, there's a possibility that infants are going to be exposed. And so you sort of need to explain why there are these risks to a disease, which is not necessarily going to be frightening in the same way. And then I think one of the things that happens in recent years when you have organizations that are really opposed to vaccination and looking for any possible way to argue against it is you look back and you say, measles isn't so scary. Everybody had measles. Your grandma had measles. Your mom had measles, right? And that's true, but it's not the point. The point is go back and look and you'll see that there were actually deaths, that there were actually children left devastated, children whose brains were badly damaged, children who ended up blind. And, those children were there too. They're, as I say, rare complications, but when a disease affects every single member of the population, you see the rare complications.
Yeah. And even beyond that, I mean, undue suffering. I think about that with the flu. Like, I am not afraid that I'm going to die of the flu. I know that many people do die of the flu, and I know that this is a legitimate public health risk. I'm not in a high-risk group, and it's very unlikely. I mean, it could happen, but it's very unlikely. So I don't, live my life in fear that I'm going to die of the flu. That said, I get a flu shot every year because I don't want to deal with getting the flu. The flu sucks.
The flu sucks. It's a totally miserable disease, and that is absolutely true. And it's also true of measles in the sense that measles is a really awful disease. I remember as a resident who had never seen measles calling in one of the senior doctors to say, this is a weird rash. Could it be measles? And this was a little bit of a joke because they would always walk in when we asked that question. And they knew we were asking because they were older. And they would usually say, your grandmother could make this diagnosis. Which was also true. But one of the things I remember learning as a resident was a senior doctor saying, no, that doesn't look like the rash at all. And also the kid is just too comfortable. Kids with measles are really miserable. Think about measles if you're seeing a kid who just seems more miserable than you can explain. And I think it's not a... And of course, there are other calculations. There are the days that lost to education, lost to school. There are the days lost that parents lose to work. There's the whole question of trying to track and trace infections and know who's been exposed and if any of those people are vulnerable. I mean, measles is from a hospital infection point of view, measles, chickenpox, these are nightmare diseases because they spread so easily and you have vulnerable people.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of kind of the version for my generation that would be measles. Actually, there's two things, HPV and chickenpox. These are two diseases that when I was a child, we did not have vaccines for. And now if I had a child, he or she would be able to be vaccinated against these diseases. And as somebody who has struggled, as many young women have, with both of these, diseases, chickenpox as a child, and of course HPV, and during a sexually active era of the life, there's a severe risk of cervical cancer. There's also literally the pain of having chickenpox. Like, it sucked. I remember it being horrible. And, maybe I wasn't close to death. Maybe ultimately for me personally, because I, grew up comfortably and had privilege, I would not have died of chickenpox. But like, I'm sure my parents would have preferred to not be bathing me in calamine lotion every night and listening to me cry myself to sleep because I was so uncomfortable. How cool that kids today just don't have to get chickenpox, which also means that they may not have to get shingles when they're older, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, chickenpox is another one of those diseases where the complications are truly rare, rarer than they are with measles. But are there children who get devastating bacterial superinfections of chickenpox lesions? Yes, there certainly are. Are there children who've had leukemia or are immune suppressed because they've had chemotherapy who get chickenpox and die? Absolutely. So again, you're protecting a vulnerable population from the more extreme manifestations, but what you say is absolutely right. You're taking out a slice of human misery. It's nowhere near as desperate as the smallpox piece, but it's significant. It's very significant for some children who have bad cases, and it's a stress in family life that you can remove. And as I say, you know, pediatricians love the idea of preventing diseases. It's not, I mean, we do all kinds of things in pediatrics, but I think you would have to say that our motivating model is not so much the heroic rescue, it's the prevent the bad things so the child can grow and develop in a healthy way. And I think one of the things that I was trying to write about when I was working on this book was the incredible, what a change it is to feel that you can prevent these diseases, that you can treat the ones you can't prevent, and that you can actually let nature take its course in the sense that you can see the child grow, develop, learn, play, live, because these bad, painful things are not getting in the way.
You know, I think that brings us back to this idea of vaccine hesitancy in sort of our modern society. And I do think that when we look at the literature, there are obvious things that contribute to vaccine hesitancy, or even, you know, what we might call a more anti-vax worldview. And some of them are cultural, some of them are religious. But it does seem to be the case that there is a growing movement, at least, of like young, affluent, progressive moms who are resistant to vaccinating their children. Do you think that most of that movement comes from the propaganda and the rhetoric that's sort of sweeping, you know, social media outlets? Do you think it's a function of literally not remembering or having no kind of perspective of what it is like for to have a devastating disease cycling through their community? Do you think it's a function of both? And how do we push back against it?
Oh, I think it's all of those things that you've named. I also think there's, in general, right now, a certain amount of pushback against the whole idea of experts and expertise in many ways, and in ways that I think sometimes hurt us badly as a society. But I certainly think that not having the memory of living with infections, not having the memory of how much harm they can do, is part of it. I think that the sense of responsibility that I was talking about, I've had a parent say to me, you know, in this conversation about vaccination, a parent say, but if I agree to vaccinate the child and the child has any kind of reaction, I, the parent, am going to feel terribly guilty. And pediatricians don't like to have to say, but think how guilty you'll feel if he gets whooping cough. But at a certain point, you sort of have to say that. And then I've had a parent respond almost like, but that wouldn't be me. That wouldn't be my decision if he got whooping cough. And I, to be honest with you, I've had a child in my practice get whooping cough when a parent had made that decision. And of course, you know, you feel so bad for the parent, you almost find yourself saying, I know you didn't mean it, right? You know, here's your child suffering and you have to watch it, and you do know that it was something you could have prevented. And what a terrible feeling, but that sometimes the parent feels that signing the consent, agreeing to give the vaccine, is somehow, you know, being more responsible, which is, of course, not right. I mean, some of this, I think we are learning over and over again, is that we have to get better at talking about this. We have to get better at explaining science. We have to get better at thinking about risk. You know, there's an obligation. It's not enough to sit here as a pediatrician and say, but I know this and I believe that, and this is what I would do with my own children, and this is what I would do with myself. All of that is true, and we can say it, but we also have to know what people are hearing, what's scaring them, what they're worrying about. I think that one of the things that's happened with vaccine hesitancy is that from within pediatrics and within medicine, we tend to think that, you know, every time anyone is honest about any kind of question or confusion or doubt regarding a vaccine, well, that proves the system works. You know, even one rare complication, we're all over it. It's reported, it's watched, it's counted. But I'm not sure that everybody in the world understands it that way. So as I say, I think there's a lot of work to do, and it's probably going to be an ongoing process, and it's going to involve figuring out who are the best messengers, who can connect best with parents in different communities, because we've seen that the anti-vaccine organizations target vulnerable communities. That the measles, in the last measles epidemic, there were these completely false publications that were circulated to Orthodox Jewish communities telling them that there was, you know, animal products in the vaccine, things that were forbidden, right? We need to be able to figure out who can speak to communities that are targeted, to vulnerable communities, to communities which have in the past not received good medical care because of prejudice, because of racism, because of marginalization. Who are the people who are going to be able to speak and be trusted and be listened to? What are the right strategies? And I think we're going to have to stay flexible and stay creative about this, because in the end, nobody wants the children to suffer.
Absolutely. I mean, and I'm glad that you brought that up, that sort of prudent paranoia that we often see in marginalized communities as a function of historical, not just disenfranchisement, not just prejudice, but in many ways abuse, you know, really, really disgusting healthcare practices. We often talk about the Tuskegee syphilis trials as kind of the premier example, but there are others. And a more kind of understanding from the healthcare perspective, you know, I think we all need to work to have a better understanding of why certain people might have hesitancy and empathize with that, so that we can address those concerns instead of sweeping them all under and just saying, oh, you were sort of caught in Jenny McCarthy's spell, because there is really so much variability in why people might not get vaccinated. But ultimately, as you mentioned, the outcome is the same. And that is, that's the really sad thing. I'm sure you've seen this, and we've seen this, especially with, I mentioned the other podcast I work on, The Skeptic's Guide, because of the topics that we cover on the show. We've had multiple people write to us when they're like 17 years old saying, I've listened to your show for a while. I'm about to have my 18th birthday, and I'm going to go get vaccinated. Or maybe they're in states where they can do it at a younger age, and saying, you know, my parents were anti-vaxxers, and I've lived my whole life to this point never having been vaccinated. And I'm just like so thrilled that I get to finally do this for myself. And it's just heartbreaking, like absolutely heartbreaking to see those kinds of emails. But it does happen. And it happens right here in our backyards in this country.
Absolutely.
So, you know, Perry, we as we were talking about a lot of the more modern implications of the book that you so beautifully wrote, going back into the historical sort of underpinnings of some of these changes in not just medical care, but public health, you tell beautiful stories. And especially, I love this, you focus quite often on, you know, women doctors and women public health advocates, like you mentioned before, Josephine Baker, but of course, Rebecca Lee Crumpler, Mary Putnam, is it pronounced Jacoby?
Jacoby, yeah.
Jacoby, yeah. And you know, unfortunately, I don't think we have the time to tell those wonderful stories, but I wanted to make sure that we at least give mention and give shout out on the show, so that as people pick up your book, if they haven't done so already, they have, you know, so much to look forward to. So it's not just a tale of how we got to where we are, and of course, where we need to go, but I think it helps us understand our present state. We so rarely, you know, engage in the important practice of mindfully reflecting on where we are today based on all of the incredible and sometimes brave and even, I don't know, I don't want to say reckless, but dangerous decisions, gosh, there's so many words I could use here, decisions and accomplishments and pressures to fly in the face of discrimination, like the people, the shoulders, you know, of the giants that we stand on today are so important because they really help us reflect. And I think maintain a certain amount of humility and gratefulness, gratitude for how lucky we are today. Of course, there's a ways to go, but goodness, when you compare that security that we have today against history, it's night and day, is it not?
I think that's absolutely true. I also found it inspiring. I, you know, found myself identifying, both admiring and also occasionally identifying with some of these early female physicians. Rebecca Lee Crumpler, who's the first African American woman to earn a medical degree in the United States. She writes an amazing book of medical discourses in the 19th century talking about, and to hear her voice, and both about the things that she couldn't, I mean, I was, you know, especially interested in her perspective on children and children getting sick and, you know, caring for children who she cared for but could not save because there was nothing anyone could do. But her courage, her leadership, but also the power of the stories that she had to tell and this determination, and this is why I again say this is an amazing thing that we've done as humans, the different pieces that come together, the individual doctors, the nurses. Nurses are amazingly important, visiting nurses, public health nurses, but also the parents, the advocates, all the different pieces. It's not one single mission, right? You can talk about a disease like smallpox or a disease like polio, where people put the pieces together and make a program and take it on. This is so many different pieces together with so many different kinds of heroes and so many voices that get involved. And as you say, so much still to do. I think it's a sort of amazing story.
Oh, I love that. And, you know, I hate to like sort of keep going back. We're about to close up the show. And I do have these two kind of big picture questions that I ask everybody at the close of the show. And I want to get to them. But it strikes me that there's a conversation that I feel like we're not having enough in public discourse. And I was hoping, because it speaks so closely to some of the things that we talked about transparency, about trust, about public health, is that, you know, I recently received my COVID vaccine and I got the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine. I did the first course about a month and a week ago, and then the second dose, or maybe it was a month now, yeah, and the second dose last week, so that 3-week time interval, because I work in a cancer center doing therapy with cancer patients, so I'm sort of, you know, obviously I work with a very immunocompromised patient population, and it was, you know, important that I not carry coronavirus or COVID-19. So, and I'm wondering, have you had your vaccines yet?
I'm working on it, but yeah.
You're working on it. All right. So one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and we did this also on the other podcast, The Skeptic's Guide, just this past week, is that I fear that the public health messaging around COVID has obviously been a kerfuffle. We know this. This whole, you know, difficulty between the change in administrations, between, you know, the really different ways that the administrations have managed everything from testing to masking to getting vaccinated, the rollout being very bumpy. But one of the things that I think has gotten lost in translation is the fact that, and maybe you could help me with this a little bit as a physician, that the COVID-19 vaccine, when people receive especially the second dose, it is normal to have some pretty intense side effects. And I feel like that conversation hasn't been had enough. And I worry that this becomes a catalyst for distrust, is when we're not transparent. And I've seen lots of articles online because healthcare workers often got the first round. And when they got the first round, some of them had pretty severe side effects from the vaccine, which is normal. It is an immune response that is normal to getting the vaccine. But there's been an argument that some people are saying, well, maybe we shouldn't really talk about it, because if we don't talk about it, then we won't, then people won't be afraid to get it. And of course, other people are saying, no, we need to be transparent. This is how you induce vaccine hesitancy.
I have heard that as well from people who've had the second dose. I've had colleagues who talked about, you know, putting out the word, don't work, don't plan to work the day that you get your second dose. So I certainly heard about that as well. And I think that at least within the healthcare field, people understand this is your immune system kicking in. This is your immune system revving up. This is your immune system turning on. It's not, you know, and the great thing is that your immune system is turning on, revving up, kicking in without you actually having to have coronavirus. You had the shot and now here goes your immune system. But I think that that is, you know, that can, unless it's explained carefully, that can seem actually scary. People are, you know, scared of shots. There's been certainly talk about people who are scared of these shots. They're new and there are several different ones. And so you not only have to think about the fact that it's, you know, a new disease, a new vaccine, it's several new vaccines. And I think we do need to talk about the fact that there's a difference between the kind of reaction that you're describing, or that the people who I know who've had a second dose and reacted to it are describing, actual, you know, bad effects, bad reactions, anaphylaxis, anything that we would consider really dangerous or untoward, but that we may be seeing that the immune system, as it turns on from some of these vaccines, turns on in a way that you can really feel.
Right. So this is why I think in most settings, at least I was lucky enough in my setting, that they had us sit for 15 to 30 minutes.
Well, the 15 to 30 minutes is to make sure that nobody anaphylaxes. It's to make sure that you don't have an immediate and dangerous allergic reaction. And honestly, that's pretty routine in most pediatric clinics when kids get any vaccine, is to observe them for at least a short time afterwards and make sure there's no immediate allergic reaction.
Right. And to be clear, you know, when I got my first dose, it felt like nothing. And then about 8 hours later, it felt like somebody punched me really hard in the arm. And it was like that for a couple of days. Okay, I could deal with that. When I got my second dose, about 12, again, it felt like nothing and I was fine. And about 12 hours later, I started to experience what we often refer to as flu-like symptoms. It's not the flu, but they're pretty, you know, unbearable flu-like symptoms. I had a fever, I had chills, my teeth were chattering, I sweat through my sheets, I had malaise, that hot, cold feeling, and my body was in pain. And that lasted almost a day. And then I had a couple days later of like a low level feeling. I took naproxen. I took a bath. I felt much better after that. I probably had what many people describe as the worst of it. And they range. Some people feel nothing. Some people feel how I did. But these are immune reactions. And it's so interesting.
I agree. I think that's important for you and other people to be talking about that, to be talking about it, that that is not allergic reaction, that's not a sort of bad reportable side effect. That is something that, you know, you understood as it was happening to you, and if nothing else, you can take it as evidence that you're immune. I mean, I've actually heard a colleague or two sort of say disappointedly, I didn't have any reaction at all. Boy, I hope that batch of vaccine was okay.
Yeah. And of course, it is the case that it runs the gamut. And when you actually look at the published data from the vaccine manufacturers, you know, it's something in the area of 30 to 40% of people have the brutal reaction like me, which means that a fair amount of people don't feel anything. And that's fine too. But yeah, it just worries me that I feel like many people aren't getting that information. And then they're surprised at home and literally scared. And of course, it comes in the middle of the night if you got vaccinated in the morning. And so then you're like, oh no, what do I do? It's normal. You take a fever reducer, you take an NSAID, and you you give yourself a day off of work. That's the important thing. But I do think, you know, I just felt responsible. It's my show, you know, 10,000 plus people are listening.
Good for you to be telling people your story.
Yeah. And so, and thank you for helping me tell that story. So beyond that, Perry, I was hoping that you might be interested in answering my two big picture questions, because I'm always fascinated by how people answer based on their life experiences and their professional experiences as well. But they are big picture. Are you ready for them?
Okay, I'll try.
All right. So I don't, not to scare you. So when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you, and of course, you've been doing that quite a bit in your work, but this could also be a personal context or anything in between. I want you to tell me, first, what is the thing that has been keeping you up at night? What is the thing that really does worry you, that you might even have a borderline pessimistic or cynical outlook on? You know, the thing that really is concerning. But then on the flip side of that, so maybe we end on a more positive note, what is the thing that you are genuinely and fundamentally really optimistic about? What are you truly looking forward to?
So I'm going to answer the first question a little bit as someone who thinks about journalism and journalists. One of the things that I worry about that keeps me up at night and worries me about the future is our increasing tendency to sort ourselves into echo chambers, to listen to the people we already agree with who confirm our prejudices, to post things that we know will be liked by the people who like us, and to therefore only listen to, read, and look at things that are written by or said by or made by the people who think like us. This echo chamber tendency, it's what leads you to believe that there are no good, smart, reasonable people in the world who might disagree with you about some important things. I mean, I'm not saying there are plenty of beliefs which I don't really find I can believe are held by nice, kind, reasonable people. But working yourself into the corner where you're only talking to and listening to the people you already agree with worries me for many reasons. And it worries me especially because we do have such capacity to connect and communicate in the world. And so that would probably lead me into the other answer, is sort of, what am I optimistic about? I am optimistic about our ability to find more and better ways to use the access we now have to knowledge, to information, to the written word. I don't think that, you know, it's something that we've all solved by any means, and I think there are lots of problematic aspects to it. But I have to believe, as somebody who thinks about children and children growing up and the possibility of being a child in one place but wanting to read about and hear about and think about other places and other ways, that we are ingenious enough as a species to figure out ways to make knowledge and the accessibility of knowledge into something which helps children's lives become richer and more full of possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And so you see that as kind of two sides of the same coin, that it's the thing that concerns you, but also the thing that gives you hope?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. And you're right. I mean, I think that one of the things that has really been worrying me, especially, it's always worried me to some extent, but it's really been brought to the forefront lately, is the technology that we have available to us now, which can open up worlds, is also used to become more and more entrenched and more separate and more maybe radicalized is even a good way to put it. And, you know, my hope is that this is a learning curve. My hope is that this is a function of it just being new. But, Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, and we'll have to work as hard as we all are working, especially those of us who are lucky enough and have the privilege of having a voice in public discourse, especially within the scientific community, whether it be journalism, science communication, advocacy, or the like, to continue to kind of beat that drum and to bring this into the forefront. So I thank you for the work that you do. I thank you for the work that you do in training the next generation, not only of doctors, to be more empathic and to think about their own histories and the history of medicine so that they have that humility in where they stand, but also in training the next generation of journalists to be able to tell these important human stories. And I thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's been really, really enlightening.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. Everybody, the book is A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future by Dr. Perry Klass. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.